Morning. I am delighted to be with you this morning, and I appreciate once again the fact that you have thought it worth your time to come and study God's Word on a weekday and a weekend, and particularly here on a Saturday morning. We're here this morning to talk about building godly marriages, and I choose that title carefully, Building Godly Marriages. I appreciate the leading of the song, God Give Us Christian Homes. I think about that frequently, and we'll probably quote from that in one of the later lessons. I do have a little quibble with that song, in the sense that it suggests that we just pray to God and He will give us Christian homes. He will give us the right kind of mothers and the right kind of fathers and the right kind of children. And I think pretty clear from anyone who has been through the process of marriage and raising children and has paid attention to the scriptures that it is not just something that happens, it is something that you have to work at. Too frequently, of course, people get married in this day and age with the presumption that it's just going to work out okay. The myth of naturalism, that is, somehow after the first 3 or 4 months of marriage and they run into a little bit of a difficulty, young married couples these days feel like, well, maybe this just wasn't meant to be. Their presumption is that if it was meant to be, they would have no problems, there would be no difficulties. But that clearly is not the case. Even the most blessed of marriages is going to run into some difficulties from time to time. And we're going to have to put some effort into it to make it the kind of marriage that we want, the kind of marriage that God wants for us. In other words, we're going to have to build that marriage. And of course, the idea of building is certainly a scriptural one. We read frequently about the church being built up and build it on the foundation of Jesus Christ. And that's the same idea, I think, when we talk about a marriage, that a marriage has to be built. It has to be constructed. You have to labor to make it work. Clearly, of course, I will give you this and the writer of the hymn, that if God doesn't watch, then the house is not safe. If God doesn't guide the building, then the marriage is not going to be built to His specifications. And that all the good things we have in this world are blessings from Him. Nonetheless, He calls upon us to engage ourselves in the process of building our marriages up. And we build beginning with a strong foundation. If you don't have the foundation right, then the rest of the edifice is in danger, no matter how carefully you may have built it. The foundation, the cornerstone of marriage, is found in Ephesians chapter 5. I think, you knew I was going to get to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 21. And I begin in verse 21 rather than verse 22 to put the context here and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. That one of the key concepts in the Bible about the church and the fellowship that exists in the church is that our being willing to be subject to one another, our willingness to honor one another. In that context, he turns specifically then in verse 22 to the concept of marriage, in which he says, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands, as to the Lord." And of course, already he has put this in a context that gives it some kind of meaning that is going to help clarify the controversy that is raised in our modern age about this idea of wives being subject to their husbands. It shouldn't be difficult for Christian women to think about being subject to their husbands, because as Christians, whether men or women, we're already subject to one another. Of course, there is a proper kind of hierarchy in the congregation. We have leaders, elders, who rule over us. But of course, even as Peter is going to say at 1 Peter chapter 5 about that leadership, it is not a lording over, a dominion over, but it is a providing of an example. In that context, then, we read, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands." Also, as to the Lord. And clearly we understand that just calling Jesus Lord indicates our recognition of His authority and His right to command us. "For the husband is the head of the wife, just as Christ also is the head of the church, He Himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything." And of course, He speaks to the wives, then He speaks to the husbands. Verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church." And the example he gives of that is that Christ gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also, he says, to love their own wives as their own bodies, and he who loves his own wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we're members of his body. And then he quotes this passage we considered last night, verse 31, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh." And he says a husband's supposed to love his wife of his own flesh, and indeed that's exactly what the nature of the marriage relationship is, that they shall become one flesh. And in verse 32, he acknowledges the difficulty that we may have with this passage, though not probably the specific difficulty that modern people have, because he says, "This mystery is great. I'm speaking with reference to the Christ and the church. Nonetheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife, even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband." So he ties together two very wonderful concepts, that is the relationship of Jesus to the church and the relationship of the husband and the wife to one another. And he says those are really kind of very comparable situations. And if you don't understand the one, you're going to have difficulty in understanding the other. And that this passage may very well be written to explain to us about the relationship of Jesus to the church by comparing it to something that we should know, the relationship of the wife to the husband. Or it may be written to explain to us the relationship of the wife and the husband based on something we already know, the relationship between Jesus and the church. But clearly this is a fundamental foundation on which the marriage has to be built, the right kinds of roles. And as controversial as this passage may be in our modern society, it remains the definitive statement of God's plan for the marriage of a man and a woman and their respective roles in the marriage. And you'll note this too about this passage. I'm sure you've been through this passage many times, but clearly you can't read this passage and read into it, you can't read out of it, you might read into it the idea that a man is responsible for keeping his wife in subjection. There's nothing in here that says to the man that you're to keep your wife into subjection, that you're to force her to be obedient. The admonition about subjection is to the wife. You need to be obedient to your husband, respectful of your husband, in subjection to your husband in everything. The admonition to the husband is very different from that. Admonition to the husband is to say, you need to love your wife like your own body. You need to love your wife in the same way that Jesus loved the church. You need to love your wife enough that you would sacrifice anything for her, even your own life. Those are, in some ways, two very different kind of admonitions, and yet they kind of circle around to the same kind of point. Before marriage, a woman has to ask herself, in light of this passage, do I love this man enough to live the rest of my life for him? And if she can't answer that in all honesty, yes, then she's not going to have a Christian marriage. She's not going to have the kind of marriage that God recommends. And probably it's not going to be the blessing that God intends for marriage to be. Can I live the rest of my life for this man? And the man who intends to marry a woman needs to ask himself this question. Do I love this woman enough to die for her? Now here's the kind of kicker to that, because most of the men are going to say, oh yeah, I would die for her. I would jump out of a plane for her. I would step in front of a bullet for her, because that's what men like to do. You know, it's like this immediate kind of heroic sort of sacrifice. But really the question is not just, would you die for her in that kind of flame of heroic glory? Would you die for her daily? Would you give your life up for her, drop by drop, moment by moment? Because after you get married, it's too late now to back out. After you get married, the wife has to ask herself, how do I live for my husband today? What do I do today that's different because I have a husband? How do I live my life for him? And the husband has to ask himself every day of his married life, what is my sacrificial love going to cause me to do for my wife today? What am I going to give up for her? And when you look at it that way, they really kind of come around to essentially the same point, do they not? It's difficult maybe to understand this idea in a vacuum of a woman being in subjection to her husband, or maybe the vacuum would be easier than understanding it in the context, the emotional context of the world in which we live today. But when we look at it in the context of what God places it here, and we look at the balance that His wisdom has given us of the man's responsibilities to the woman and the woman's responsibilities to the husband, it is not that difficult to understand. And it's at heart not even that different a kind of requirement that God is asking of the man and of the woman. But it is difficult in our society today for both a man and a woman to join together in this kind of a trusting covenant relationship of marriage, because we think too much about our own ideas of happiness. Our foundation documents say, in fact, that we all have these God-ordained rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I'm not exactly sure which one drew Jefferson's mind when he transmuted that phrase, which had always in the past been life, liberty, and property, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But we certainly have embraced that in our hedonistic society today, that we are entitled to be happy. And if you ask people why they're getting married, they very frequently say, I'm getting married so I can be happy. And then, of course, the consequence is if they're married and they're not happy, it's like that invalidates the marriage, because the whole point was to be happy, and it's not making them happy, so they need to get rid of this wife, this husband, and they need to get another one that will make them happy. But that's not really the point of marriage. And from the point of view of which God speaks about it here, the question is not, will this marriage make me happy? Will this person make me happy? The question is, can I make that person happy? Can I make this marriage happen? That's the responsibility that we have. And we can't shirk that responsibility based on, you know, some kind of emotional feelings that we may have about the nature of marriage or what the purpose of marriage is. God's pretty clearly established for us the mutual kind of sacrifice in husband and wives after that. And, you know, if you're not willing to make the kind of sacrifice that He asks of you as a young woman, or as a man, then you probably ought not to be engaged to marry. You ought not to marry at all until you're able to understand and able to commit yourself to this kind of sacrifice. Are you willing to live for that man the rest of your life, every day of the rest of your life? Are you willing to die and give up your life for that woman, every day, drop by drop, for the rest of your life? And I guarantee you, if we approach marriage on that basis, even if we've been married for 10 or 15 years and we think about it today, say, what can I do today to indicate to my wife that I am willing to die for her? What can I give up to make her happy today? And the wife is at the same time thinking, how can I live my life today for my husband to make him happy? That's going to create a much more happy relationship than any other approach that we may take. And God knew that, of course, from the beginning. That's the foundation. The building, the structure, I think we can find in another passage in 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. And in 1 Peter chapter 3, we have through these first seven verses of 1 Peter chapter 3, a description about how to build a marriage, a godly marriage. And in fact, it is in the context of how to build a godly life and all kinds of other relationships, including the relationships that we have to the government, the relationships that we have to our bosses, our servants have to their masters. But here in chapter 3 of 1 Peter, first two verses, he has something to say about the wives. And it fits with the foundation that we've already built in Ephesians chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. And of course, here's the difficulty for women, and they frequently feel this way. Of course, I could live that way. I could live according to Ephesians chapter 5, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1 and 2. I could live that way for the right kind of man. Well, and maybe if that's the case, you should give some serious thought to who you marry in the first place, right? You should make some pretty careful considerations about that, because when you get married, it's a lifetime commitment. Is this person the kind of person that you're willing to give your life to? A lot of women say, I could do that for the right kind of man, but my husband's not that way. Well, that's exactly the point that Peter's talking about here. Because what he's talking about here are non-believing husbands. And he's saying, you wives, you have non-believing husbands, here's the way you need to live your life. You need to live your life in such a way that you might win them for Christ. You might change them for Christ by the way you live your life in a loving, submissive way toward them, as you are chaste and respectful in your behavior. And of course, he uses the example of Sarah for this as he goes on to talk about Sarah and the way in which she conducted herself in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 5. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. And, of course, it's like, oh my, if I was Sarah and I were married to Abraham, what a wonderful life I would have. Well, you haven't read the Bible story if you think that's the case. You go back and read about Abraham, and as much as he was a man of faith, he was not an easy man to live with, I can assure you of that. From her point of view, being in that marriage, he snatches her from one home to another, and then he just wanders around in tents in the land of Canaan and never receives any of that land until finally he buys a plot of it to bury her in. Twice he kind of denied his relationship with her and got her into almost serious kind of difficulty because he lied about their marriage. He took her son early one morning off to a mountain somewhere to sacrifice him. She has no idea about that. He was a strange man in some ways, a difficult man to live with. And, of course, she still provides an example, according to the Holy Spirit, of the way a woman ought to be respectful toward her husband. Doesn't matter whether he's the right kind of man or not. You need to live the right kind of life so that with your chaste conduct that you can change him and win him without speaking a word to him, just by the example. The guy may be irascible, irritable, and ornery, but he usually isn't blind and completely out of touch with reality. He can see the difference in the behavior of a woman who is chaste and winsome versus one who is equally as irritable and ornery as he is. We need to be careful about using this passage in some kind of pragmatic sort of manipulative way. It isn't the point that we're going to manipulate somebody by our own behavior. It's not like Romans chapter 12, which says, don't avenge yourself, but give grace to wrath so that you may put heaps of coal upon their head. It's not like that that you're supposed to try and make him feel bad by the way you're nicer than he is. That's not the point. That's not the attitude that is described here. It is a matter that if you do the thing that you ought to do, that's got to have an influence on your husband or your wife in that relationship. He observes conduct, Peter said. Observes is a word that suggests more than just casually notices it. He studies it. It's like a puzzle to him. Why is this woman behaving this way when I'm not behaving the way I ought to? It is a living Bible lesson each day by which she may change him. Not by deliberate manipulation. You're always worried about that. When you hear a bride or an engaged girl and her mother talking about the groom and suggesting, you know, he's got a lot of potential. We could just change this a little bit. We could change that a little bit. We could get him to cut his hair. We could get him to wear some better clothes. We could get him to live better. And it's like, that marriage is going to be in trouble. That's for sure. Because you enter in, I'm going to change this person deliberately. You got problems. You got to love them the way they are. And maybe they will change, and maybe they will change for the better. But the way in which you accomplish that is the way the Bible suggests that, not by some deliberate kind of manipulation. Without a word, he says. And I don't know exactly whether he has this idea in mind or not, but one of the things that very frequently occurs that makes marriages not particularly pleasant is the fact that the wife uses a lot of words. In fact, so many words that we use the term nagging. You know where the word nagging comes from? It is a Scandinavian word that comes from the bubonic plague in Europe, when the fleas that were on the mice scattered the disease in all the households. But the reason there was so much bubonic plague was because there were so many fleas, because there were so many mice, that at night when the lights went out, you could hear them gnawing, 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 noggin, 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 noggin. And that's the word that we take and make for nagging. That's not going to change somebody. That's just going to harden them. That's just going to worsen the relationship. Without a word, but by her chaste conduct, she can win him for the Lord. And of course, verses 3 and 5 talks about the adornment of the woman. Let your adornment not be merely external, as the New American Standard adds in that kind of interpretive word. Your adornment must not be external, braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, putting on dresses, but the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable qualities of a gentle and a quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. And of course, the obvious implication here is exactly as the New American Standard suggests, not merely that external appearance is not of paramount importance, but really the focus should be on being the right kind of a person. But I'll tell you this, the right kind of a person will display itself in outward behavior, in outward facial expressions, in outward words that they speak, in the way in which they conduct themselves, in the clothing that they wear. There is the very fact that we use this idea of adornment as a metaphor for the kind of chaste behavior and spirit that this woman has, a recognition that, in fact, appearances are important. And that is going to be important that we pay attention to the way in which we appear to the people around about us, and particularly how we appear to our husband or how we appear to our wife. And of course, here's the other side of that lesson. Particularly for men, what are you paying attention to? What are you looking for when you look at the appearances of a woman? When you're choosing a bride, or whether you're looking to your own wife, what is it that you're looking at by which you are pleased? Is it merely external, or is it that you're pleased by the kind of gentle spirit that she has, the kind of Christ-like behavior that she engages in? Do you notice those kinds of things? And of course, compliments are always welcome and appreciated. And in fact, I might suggest a compliment a day is better than an apple a day for keeping the doctor away. The compliment a day is really a way in which you might want to think about improving your marriage relationship. And a compliment about appearance is relatively easy. We do that all the time. But maybe compliments about character, compliments about behavior would be much more meaningful, and would be meaningful in two ways. One, it tells the other person, we are observing the right kind of things about you. These are the things that ought to be emphasized in your life. And secondly, it reminds us of what really is important to us, that we really ought to be paying attention to the kind of person that we are engaged to, or the kind of person that we are married to. And of course, we talk about the idea here in this passage next. When we talk about the woman, we're talking about not just the issue of her chaste behavior and her appearance, but we're talking about the fact that it is incorruptible. It's not going to be changed. It is not something that's variable from day to day, or month to month, or year to year. And of course, our appearance, as we get older, obviously changes. So what's really important is having the kind of quality of character that doesn't change, that doesn't deteriorate with time, that maybe, if anything, improves with time. Sometimes, of course, the things that makes women attractive in our society that men pay attention to are really pretty transitory. And of course, that's a condemnation, not maybe of the women so much as it is of the men. That's what they're paying attention to. We ought to be paying attention to the things that are permanent, the things that are incorruptible, the things that are just untouched by time. Clark Gable had this great line. He said to one of the women in one of the movies, and I forget which one it is, he said, "I've seen women I'd look at sooner, but I haven't seen any I'd look at longer." And the idea is, that we want to choose someone that we can live with forever, for the rest of our lives at least here on this planet. Maybe it's much better. Maybe your mother said something about that to you. You need to find a wife you can look at across the breakfast table for the next 50 years, if God blesses you with that many years or more. You need to find somebody that you can appreciate their character. That's the importance, the gentle, quiet character. And of course, when we hear those words gentle and quiet, so many people today, young women particularly, say, you know, I don't want to be a doormat. The exaggerated pejorative speech of today about the spiritual things. And it's clearly true. Some women are much more likely by nature to be quiet and gentle, and some are much more kind of outgoing and boisterous about that. But these character traits are the kind of things that we're called upon to develop as Christians, gentle and quiet, and certainly as Christian women in our relationship to our husbands. What Peter is saying, in other words, is she's not the kind of person who is demanding of her own way, that she is, as we began in Ephesians chapter 5, willing to live her life for her husband. And she does that, as he suggests in verse 6, by obeying her husband. And the word obedience here is an interesting word that suggests being in subordination to, doing what you're told to do, but it means much more than that. It means being attentive to. Listening not just for orders, but anticipating what the needs of the husband are going to be. The idea is that the wife is attentive to her husband's needs. And she pays attention. She anticipates. And it's not as if the husband is going to say to her, you know, I want you to do this. I want you to wash these clothes. I want you to fix this meal. Maybe he does that. Maybe he doesn't. But it is, she's already anticipated. Those are the things that he needs because she's living her life for him. She wants to pay attention to his needs and to fulfill those needs. My students are always like, you know, what does this mean? Does it mean that he gets to tell her to fix his dinner on time? I want the dinner on the table every night at 5:30, and I want mashed potatoes and gravy every night. And they get really exercised about that. And they say, well, if he loved me, he wouldn't tell me to do that. And I said, well, that's probably true. But if you loved him, he wouldn't have to tell you to do that. If you knew that's what he wanted, that's what you'd be fixing for him, right? That's the kind of man you want to marry, that you have those sort of feelings for. And that's what makes the marriage happy, is you're anticipating each other's needs. And of course, that's scary. That is scary to think about putting yourself in the power of another person that way. It's scary for women. It's scary for men too, because I guarantee you, you get married to a woman, you are in her power. If you love her, you are in her power. If you're in the house with her, you're in her power. As Jerry Clower used to say, if mama ain't happy, nobody ain't happy. You've got to make one another happy, and they will make you happy, as opposed to trying to make yourself happy about that. It's a frightening thing to do, but that's what Peter says here. Do good without being frightened. You understand that God has created marriage for the best. And you trust this man because you were very careful about the person you gave your life to. And you trust this woman because you were very careful about the person that you gave your life to. So it's a pretty powerful passage, and we pay attention to that. And then many people have noticed, of course, you know, we've just been talking about the wife. Well, of course, I've tried to make that about the husband as well. But this really, he's saying to the wives, this is the way you're supposed to behave. And he's got all of six verses in which he describes that, and then only one verse, although it's a long verse, about the husbands. Verse 7, you husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered. And, of course, you know, there is nothing significant about the fact that there's six verses to the wife, one verse to the husband. You know, some people like, you know, wives need a whole lot more instruction than we do as men. And some women are like, you know, men can't take very much instruction at any one time anyway, so we just give them one verse. Yeah, it's just the kind of the way we do in our modern society about that. But what he says in verse 7 is pretty complete, isn't it? He says you need to live with your wife in an understanding way. And of course, a lot of men, they just jump right on that. Live with them. I do. I come home every night. What else does she expect? My clothes are in the closet. My truck's in the driveway. That's where I live. He said, well, that's good, you know. But really, we're talking about more than just, you know, this is where you live. This is where you hang your hat. This is a dwelling and abiding together. It's a closeness between the husband and the wife. You have to live with them. Not just be in the house where they are, but have this kind of relationship that means dwelling and abiding together. Of course, the common complaint of many wives is, my husband doesn't talk to me. And of course, you know, the husbands are like, you know, I told you I loved you when I got married. And, you know, if I change my mind, I'll let you know. You need to share. You need to talk together. It's always amazing, isn't it? You go to the restaurant, and there's a couple over here, and they're leaning across tables, staring intently at mother, and they're talking back and forth. There's another couple over here, and they're sitting back, concentrating on their food, not a word exchanged between them. And you're like, pretty sure that's a dating couple over there talking, and that's a married couple over there not talking. Because they've already exhausted all of that. No, you got to work on that. You need to live with your wives in an understanding way. It's not just a hotel with maid service and meals and everything else thrown in. It is a home in which you have to live with your wife in an understanding way. And lots of men, you know, they just pour enormous efforts into making sure the house is just right. It's always painted. They got the, you know, new latest kind of wind impact windows in. They got the landscaping just right. They work on the house all the time. Well, let's work on the home as well. Let's make the home a dwelling in which your wife feels is cared for and tended to as the house is. It's not just enough for husbands to come at the house every day. They have to be there with their wives. And they have to lay aside the newspaper and lay aside the phone and talk to their wives. Understand their wives. And a lot of people, you know, they think that this is just the fact of the case. Marriage starts out exciting, and then it just kind of gets routine, humdrum, bound to be less exciting and duller as you move along through the years. Well, and if you want to settle for a mediocre marriage, that's okay. You can do that. But marriage is like a living plant. It constantly needs water and fertilizer and care. You got to tend to the marriage. And the longer you're married, the more you put into it, the more you get out of it, the more it means to you. I had this experience several years ago, talking over here, and the women were talking over there, and this man's wife was over there, happy and beaming and cheerful, and he looked at her and he said, I made her that way. And I thought, well, that's a little bit kind of self-centered about that. But maybe so, because you have a great impact on the kind of person that your spouse is going to be. We have the power to make or break our partner's spirit and well-being. That's what it means to be tied together in this one flesh relationship. And I guarantee you, any effort you put into your spouse is going to pay dividends beyond anything that you could expect. I mean, we invest in our 401ks, we invest in our education, we invest in so many things in life because we expect to get something back out of it. Let's invest in our spouse, invest in our marriages. Because anything you invest in your spouse is going to come back to you. And it's going to come back in multiple payments. Because we're really investing in ourselves, are we not? Because it's a one flesh relationship. And we can make our spouse happy, we can make ourselves happy. This idea that the husband is going to live with his wives in an understanding way suggests the idea that he has to lead. She is in submission. That means he has to provide a direction, a guidance for her. And one of the great problems that I see in America today is that young men are not being trained to be leaders, and that unfortunately when they get married, they can't provide the kind of leadership that the women need, that their wives need, in order to give them the respect that God says they must be given. It is into a vacuum of leaderless men that women rush to take this kind of an idea that somehow they're not supposed to be in subjection. They're supposed to be the ones that are in charge. And of course, if nobody else is in charge, sometimes the women are going to have to do that. Because the idea that God made women inferior is just not the case. When it said God made the woman a help suitable for the man, you know, I'm thinking to myself, God wants to make a helper that's suitable. You know, what kind of helper do we want? What kind of helper do we need? If God's going to make a helper that's suitable, he makes one that can get the job done. And women, of course, are very competent, perfectly capable of getting things done, of providing the kind of assistance and aid that a man needs. And if the husband doesn't provide the kind of leadership, then clearly his wife is going to fill that vacuum, because somebody has to get things done, and she's the one who will be able to do that. You know, one of the things that is clear about this is leadership, even in management textbooks today, is not about domineering. It's not about forcing people to do things. It's not about coercing them to do things. It's not about just even using an illegitimate authority to say, you do this or you're going to be fired. It is about encouraging and developing people so they can exercise their talents. And that's surely going to be the case in a marriage, that the husband needs to encourage the talents of his children, needs to encourage the talents of his wife. He needs to do that in a way in which he understands who she is. You could do this kind of test, maybe I'm just saying too much about myself, but pretty much every wife here is going to know what color her husband likes, what his preferences are in clothes, what his preferences are in his food and his drink. But the men probably don't know nearly as much about what their wives want, what their wives like. And maybe that's a part of this, you know, we should live with them in an understanding way. We need to learn to be empathetic and sensitive to their feelings, in the way they're empathetic and sensitive to our feelings. You know, like in My Fair Lady, they said, why can't a woman be more like a man? Maybe the issue in marriage is, why can't a man be more like a woman? Why can't they be more sensitive, more interested, more attentive, more understanding of the emotions of their wives? Live with your wife in an understanding way. Empathy. Recognize what she needs and what she wants in her life. You know, there are a number of ways in which we may build up a marriage and make it what it ought to be. But one of the most significant things that indicate whether marriage is happy or not is the constant exchange of tokens of affection. An indicator to the other person that I like you, I respect you, I love you. And of course, the most obvious of those tokens of affection would be to say, I love you. And of course, some families, they say that every day in every way. And that's great. Others say it without the words. We can say it by doing things for the other person. We can say it by giving them other kinds of compliments, by saying, I respect the way you do this, I admire the way you do that or the other. The husband in particular has this responsibility. According to Peter, he's to honor his wife as the weaker vessel. Do you give your wife honor? Do you show her respect and appreciation? That's the question that husbands need to ask themselves when they read this kind of passage. Do they demonstrate to their wife that she is valued and respected? And of course, I don't know, we could spend a lot of time debating this issue about the weaker vessel and what exactly that means about the weaker vessel. And of course, in many ways, maybe wives physically have less strength than men, and maybe that's merely the thing that he refers to here. Typically, women are going to live longer than men. That wouldn't suggest that they were weaker. And if you have blessing of children, and you've seen your wife go through pregnancy and bring children into the world, and you're like, I'm glad she did that. I'm not sure I can do that. They're not weaker vessels in that way. But most women are weaker emotionally. They're more sensitive and more tender. And we need to recognize how fragile they are, and we need to take care of that. We honor the things that are costly in our lives. Some men, they take so great care of their trauma. I used to be kind of guy like that, and I had a girl that was, I was dating, and she put her feet up on the dash of my truck. And I was like, I stopped and I said, you know, get out. That's not a woman. But if my wife wanted to put her feet up on my car now, it's fine, you know. She can do that. That's what she wants to do. We take care of the things that are valuable to us. We put our trophies up in special places. We dust them off. We point to them. We tell people about them. How much more ought we to give honor to our wives? Particularly because of the kind of blessing that they bring into our lives. We understand. I think that all of this is in the context of building a happy marriage. But there is this further kind of an idea that Peter offers here in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 when he says, honor her as a fellow heir of the grace of life so that your prayers will not be hindered. That the ultimate purpose of marriage, I think, ought to be for those of us who are Christians to get to heaven. And that it is by being married to the right kind of person and being the right kind of person in marriage that we can help one another to attain that goal of heaven with Jesus Christ. That's what we're ultimately aiming for. And Peter suggests if you're not the right kind of husband, your prayers are going to be hindered. God's not going to hear those in the way that you want him to. And I don't know whether he's indicating that because we're not the right kind of husbands, that we're not going to pray as we ought to, or that we're not the right kind of husbands, that God's going to hold that against us as we make our prayers. But I do understand this, that one of the greatest ways in which God helps us to obey him in this life, to fulfill our commitment to Jesus Christ, to remain faithful, and to find our way into heaven, is through marriage and the right kind of marriage. What a wonderful blessing it is that God has given us. And we're just that inkling of the kind of blessing that we have of relationship to Jesus in the church, and a hint of the sort of blessing that we will have and the kind of union that we will have with the fellow believers and Christ himself in heaven. And of course, as we're gathered together in Jesus' name, we do not want to conclude a lesson without giving an opportunity to those who may want to render obedience to him to do so. So we're going to send now and sing this song. And those of you who have some need, you can come forward and we will try and assist you.